This is Professor Richard Carlson, and this is the employment law lecture for the class scheduled for November 10. In our last class, we studied illegal motivations for discharge. These are cases in which the employer has acted not only unfairly, but for an illegal reason. In these cases, the employee, however, must prove more than that his discharge was unfair. He has to prove that it was for an illegal reason. The most widely recognized illegal reasons for discharge are those forms of discrimination prohibited by laws like Title VII, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, or the Americans with Disabilities Act. But as we've seen in this course, there are a wide variety of other illegal motivations, many of them pertaining to protected conduct. Now, early in our last class, we turned to the subject, how does one prove that an employer acted for an illegal, discriminatory, or retaliatory purpose? And we found that the same models for proof of discrimination that we studied in connection with employee selection also apply to employee termination. We just have to adjust the formula to account for the fact that we're talking about a rejection, not just a rejection from selection, but an actual termination from existing employment. Remember that the employee bears the initial burden of producing a prima facie case, but that's a pretty light burden. And if the employee relies on the McDonnell-Douglas model for an inference of discrimination, the facts are at least initially quite scant, but they shift the burden of production to the employer so that the employer must articulate a legitimate non-discriminatory reason, his LNR. And we consider the question then, what happens if the employee rebuts the employer's LNR, if the employee persuades the fact finder that the employee's LNR is false? The effect the court held in the St. Mary's Honor case is that the rebuttal of the LNR creates only a permissive, not a mandatory inference of discrimination, so that the fact finder, jury or judge, might still find that discrimination or other illegal motivation was not the cause of the discharge. From there, we turned to a special class of illegal motivations for discharge. We consider the problem of protected conduct when employees act in the public interest. This is an especially problematic area because there's nothing like a Title VII that gives us a general law of wide applicability to a wide definition of employee protected conduct. Instead, what we have are a lot of very particular anti-retaliation provisions that are attached to other employment laws or to other regulatory statutes. And these specific anti-retaliation provisions leave a lot of gaps, either because they are of limited coverage, because of their sometimes peculiar ways of defining protected conduct, or because we're dealing with an employee whose action in the public interest was to support a public policy for which there is no specific anti-retaliation provision. This leads to the question whether courts can invoke their power to develop the common law, whether by tort or contract, to fill the gaps that are left by these statutes. And we saw last time two radically different approaches. The Oregon approach, represented by the Benitez case, suggests that courts retain a broad common law authority to determine or to provide remedies for employees who are injured by an employer's retaliatory action, provided the employee was acting in the public interest. The Texas approach, on the other hand, has been quite narrow. The Texas courts have adopted the view that the courts should defer to the legislatures for purposes of defining what employee conduct is protected and what remedies are appropriate for employer retaliation. Next slide. We begin today's lecture with the question of employee good faith and employer responds, Wichita County versus Hart is a case that illustrates the problem of employees being a little bit off target when they make their charges against the employer in a case involving the public interest. Remember that most employees haven't been to law school. They have a sense of what's right and what's wrong. When it comes to complicated regulatory rules, their idea of what the law requires may be a little bit off, sometimes a lot off, but frequently they're acting in good faith. They really believe that the employer may have violated the law or that the employer might be preparing to violate the law, and perhaps they either question, refuse to carry out an order, or report what they thought was illegal activity. So we begin today's lecture with the question, what happens when the employee is wrong? And that, of course, is the whole problem in Wichita County versus Hart. Next slide. This is a Texas Whistleblower Act case. We really do have a statute for this in Texas. Our Whistleblower Act applies only, though, to public employees. It doesn't apply to the private sector. These employees are in the public sector, so that's not a problem for them. Their larger difficulty is that in blowing the whistle, which is ordinarily protected by the Texas Whistleblower Act, they may have been wrong. The Act, by its terms, states that the employee has to report a violation of the law. It doesn't say what the employee believes is a violation of the law. It just says the employee has reported a violation of the law to an appropriate law enforcement official. We'll get down to the heart of this case, which is going to involve a remand for further proceedings. The issue will be on remand, what should be the jury instructions? How should we tell the jury to resolve the issues in this case, particularly when there's an argument that the employee was just wrong? His interpretation of the law was incorrect, or his interpretation of the facts was incorrect. The consensus, not only in Texas, but I would say almost across the board for purposes of whistleblowing and other public interest action by employees, is that a good faith error in making the report is still protected. You would want that extra degree of protection, because otherwise employees would be at such great risk of error that they would never take the risk of blowing the whistle. If it could ever be proven that they were wrong in any significant respect, whether they believed they were right or not at the time, it just wouldn't matter, and they'd lose their protection. And remember that most employees fear, rightly or wrongly, that the employer comes armed with much greater legal resources. The employer can call together a vast in-house legal department, or they can call on additional law firms with their much more substantial financial resources to defend the legality of what the employer had either done or was attempting to do. So to encourage employees to blow the whistle or otherwise act reasonably in favor of the public interest, we should signal to them that they don't have to be perfectly right as long as they acted in good faith. The deeper and more complicated question is, how do we explain to a jury what we mean by good faith? The defendant county in this case argued for a subjective approach. And there are two sides to what we mean by subjective good faith. One would be whether the individual plaintiff actually did believe that he was reporting illegal conduct. And in order to actually peer inside the mind of the plaintiff employee, we need to take account of the fact that the employee may have been a deputy, better educated than most employees, more experienced, and therefore more knowledgeable about what was legal and what was not legal. That's because, of course, we can never know for sure what the plaintiff employee was thinking. He'll always, of course, or most likely deny under oath that he acted in bad faith. But there's another aspect to this theory of subjective good faith that's even more important in this case, and that's the question of motive. Employees who blow the whistle may be acting in the public interest, but not necessarily. It may be that they are blowing the whistle purely for their own bargaining purposes with the employer. Maybe they're doing it opportunistically. Maybe they've wondered for years whether something was illegal, but they never felt motivated to do anything about it. They only blew the whistle when they didn't get what they wanted or they wanted to retaliate against the employer for something else. If that's part of this idea of subjective good faith, that would mean, for example, the county is allowed to argue at trial that these deputies were trying to get back at the sheriff. They may or may not have believed that the sheriff had actually violated the law. More important to them was to create a lot of trouble for the sheriff. Now, the plaintiffs argue in response in favor of an objective approach. Their objective approach would depend on what a reasonable person might have believed under the circumstances. Would the average reasonable person have believed that the sheriff had acted illegally or that his actions were in violation of a particular law? But perhaps more importantly, under their objective theory, actual motive should be irrelevant. In other words, we should protect employees regardless of why it is that they blew the whistle or engaged in other protected conduct. The fact that they had a basis to believe they were reporting illegal conduct is sufficient, even if they were blowing the whistle for purely selfish or retaliatory purposes. Next slide. The Texas Supreme Court resolves this by adopting a hybrid of objective and subjective approaches. Pulling together the best strands of both approaches, the court holds that, number one, the employee is only protected if he had an objectively reasonable belief regarding the law. We might add that subsequent cases have suggested that the same standard applies to belief about the facts, because frequently this is not just a question of interpreting the law. Employees have to interpret the facts that they've learned. They have to make some guess about what they think is happening based on what they can observe, and that's a factual issue. In this case, what the court holds is that the jury should first determine that it was reasonable, based on objective facts, to form the belief that the employee harbored. Secondly, and this resembles a little bit more of the subjective approach, the reasonableness of the employee's belief has to be viewed in light of that particular employee's training and experience. Now, that's important in a case like Wichita County versus Hart, because we're dealing with deputies here, and we might be inclined to believe that they have a better idea of what the law requires. Well, that's certainly true with respect to some parts of the law, for example, criminal law enforcement. But to the extent that we're talking about accounting violations, financial violations, and certain other types of legal requirements, I suspect that the status of the plaintiffs as deputies probably wouldn't make much difference. Third aspect of this hybrid approach, reasonableness of the employee's beliefs relates purely to belief in the law or the facts, not to actual motivation. And this is a really important distinction here, because it means that employers can't defend themselves by proving that the employee himself had his own illegal or evil motive. For example, it's no defense that the employee was only trying to get back at you because he didn't get the promotion that he wanted. It's no defense, perhaps, that the employee allowed the illegality to go on for years, never complaining about it, but only complained and blew the whistle when he had some reason to be angry at the employer. Now, this does seem, in fact, to track a general trend in whistleblower protection law, which is to say, we want to encourage employees to act in favor of the public interest, but we don't necessarily care whether protecting the public interest is really their motivation, as long as that's the effect. And if you want to see another example of this kind of theory, one need look no farther than the False Claims Act and other recent federal legislation, which grants employees a bounty, a pot of gold, for reporting fraudulent behavior by their employers. In other words, we understand that a lot of employees will not necessarily blow the whistle if the only reason to do so is to support the public interest, we're going to give them a bonus. If they report illegal activity by their employer, we're going to pay them for doing so. And the bounty for reporting employer fraud under the False Claims Act, for example, can be quite substantial. Doesn't matter what the motivation was that the employee had. If he was doing it purely out of greed, that's fine, as long as the result to the public interest is good. Next slide begins the problem of retaliatory action. How many ways are there that an employer can retaliate? Well, of course, the most extreme methods of retaliation, such as termination of an employee, are clearly illegal, but as we're going to find out, there are many, many ways to retaliate. Next slide. What adverse actions constitute unlawful retaliation? The problem here is somewhat analogous to the problem of sexual harassment. It's so analogous, in fact, that I have to warn you that a lot of judges and lawyers have gotten deeply confused here. They've approached cases as harassment cases when, in fact, it was a retaliation case, and there may be reason to distinguish between the two. One basic problem is this. Imagine that you've just been charged with being a crook or a bigot. Your reaction to this is to take personal offense. Now, the person who charged you with being a crook and a bigot happens to sit in the next cubicle. He happens to be your subordinate. And from the very beginning, going back a couple of years, when he first started working with you, you've had a routine of going out to lunch together every week. Now it's really hard to invite him to go to lunch with you. It's really hard to sit down and be sociable to somebody who has gone to the federal authorities and has reported that you're a lawbreaker and he's trying to get you in trouble. Now, that's simply the way that you might look at it. Of course, the employee who's blowing the whistle has his own way of looking at this. The point is that we can expect that the person who is reported as the wrongdoer is going to have a hard time dealing civilly with the whistleblower. And thus the question is this: should we require as a legal mandate that the party who has been charged must act civilly to the whistleblower, and if he doesn't, can the court remedy incivility? And this is the court's great dilemma, because if we say we aren't going to turn the law into a general civility code, the risk is that we've adopted a high standard for proof for the employee and a very low standard for employer conduct that tends to invite subtle employer retaliation. And I don't think I need to ask you to imagine under too much strain all of the ways that an employer might retaliate against you without simply firing you. I'm sure that you can appreciate that there are many ways of making a person's life miserable without firing them. And this is particularly true if they work for you and you control every aspect of their work every day. Now, this really breaks out into two separate issues. Number one, how material must adverse action be? How significant or extreme or harmful must it be? And second, must the action affect the employment with the employer? And if you're wondering what I mean by this, understand that there are ways that an employer can retaliate that don't relate to the job itself, but that relate to life after work, maybe after termination. For example, if I'm the employer and I want to retaliate against you, maybe you've already resigned. You've known well enough not to stick around in a place where you've just reported massive tax fraud. You know, people are not going to be happy with you. It's going to be a difficult place to work. You understood that. You resigned. But now I'm still going to retaliate against you by spreading word throughout the industry that you're the crook. You are a fraud. You engaged in all kind of financial mismanagement. And that's the story of what really happened. Now, that's post-employment retaliation. In a sense, it doesn't really relate to your employment or affect your employment with me, yet it is still clearly a harmful form of retaliation. Next slide. brings us to Burlington Northern versus White. It raises both of the questions that I've just posed for us. Next slide. Was it unlawful retaliation? Poor White has been complaining about discrimination that she suffered. And she starts out properly by filing an internal complaint. I say properly because in many instances it's a good way to begin. It certainly adds some credibility if you've tried to deal reasonably with the problem and responsibly. It's not always possible, by the way, depending on the way things work at your workplace, but it might be. But this just invites retaliation in this case, so this leads to an external complaint directly to the EEOC, additional retaliation, a second complaint about the retaliation that she suffered, and that results in a disciplinary suspension, also evidently retaliatory. Now, I have a bullet there about an omitted issue to make this case reasonably short. I edited out a rather interesting part of the court's decision, and I want to talk about it a little bit simply because it's worth keeping your eye on this issue. It's going to happen a lot in the future. The employer tried to deal with this problem internally. The employer had its own internal grievance system. The reason that we're going to see this kind of fact pattern in the future is that the law is really pushing employers to create such a grievance system to deal with these things internally. And the employer, to its merit, concluded that this was a case of illegal retaliation. They put White back in her job, and they even gave her back pay. Now, the defense at this stage is, how can we be guilty of any discrimination? How can we be liable if we've already remedied the retaliation? The answer is that the employer can't really make White whole under these circumstances, or at least hasn't in this case, because under Title VII, she might still be entitled to further compensatory damages in addition to back pay. She might be entitled to punitive damages. Not likely, given the way the employer's upper management dealt with this particular situation, but it could happen, and we have to let the fact finder make that decision. And finally, she might be entitled to injunctive relief, depending on the circumstances. So the court holds that the mere fact that the grievance system did its work and put Mrs. White back on the job is not enough to render this case moot. Next slide. We start with the question of how adverse the employer's action has to be in order to constitute a violation. I had an interruption here, so I'm guessing where I left off. I believe we were speaking about what constitutes materially adverse action. This is the standard that the court adopts for purposes of the seriousness or significance of the employer's action. Now, this is a Title VII case, so the court's got to base its opinion on the actual words of the statute. Not all anti-retaliation statutes are going to say the same thing. Sometimes we're going to be dealing with the common law, and there is no statute. We simply have judicial policy. But what the court says here is still pretty important. It demonstrates an effort to lean in favor of a broad definition of what might constitute retaliation. In this case, the court has the benefit of some surprisingly broad statutory language in Title VII. Title VII, when it prohibits discrimination, race discrimination, or gender discrimination, it says that it has to involve a term of employment. The court holds that the retaliation provision of Title VII is broader because it prohibits any kind of retaliatory discrimination without qualification. It doesn't have to relate to particular types of terms of employment. So we're dealing with a fairly wide open standard of things that constitute discrimination. On the other hand, the court doesn't want to invent a general civility statute, so it holds that there is a limit to what will count as actionable discrimination. First, it's got to be material in the sense that it would deter a reasonable employee from engaging in the protected conduct. And we can imagine that a lot of subtle methods of humiliation might be enough to deter you from doing the right thing. Second, the employer's action need not be an employment action. For example, it could involve some action the employer takes against you after you've already resigned. It might also involve the employer's action in some non-employer capacity. For example, maybe the employer is a bank, and you've gone to your own employer for a loan. The employer rejects your application for a loan. That's not really an employment action. It's more of a customer action. But if it is retaliatory and motivated by an intent to retaliate, it could still qualify as discrimination under this statute. Next slide. We move now into a new section on mitigating the impact of termination. Assuming you have no particular remedy against the employer, what does the legal system do to cushion the blow? And we'll see a number of rules that soften the blow of termination or limit the impact. Next slide. From the employee's point of view, a top priority is to protect your reputation. After all, if you've been fired, this suggests that maybe you did something wrong. And therefore, we have to consider the legal protection that the employee might have when a former employer's defamatory comments deflate your future job prospects. Next slide. Here's an example of a typical setting for issues of discrimination. Let's talk about what happened in this fact setting. It's based on a real case, by the way. Loosely based on that, and it gives rise to a lot of the different issues that can come up in a defamation case involving an employment relation. The next slide now, defamation law in a nutshell, gives us some of the things that we should look for in a case like this. Number one, we have to have publication. You'll note that there was the possibility of defamation at several stages here. You have the reporting of the test result itself. That report was by the outside laboratory. Secondly, you have reports within the employer organization, people talking about the test results, the management team investigating the problem. Next, you'll have the report by the employer vice president, who talks about the problem of the employee to other people outside the company when he's having cocktails at an industry convention. So we have three possibilities for publication there. Here's the problem. First of all, with respect to the employer, there's a question whether or not we can treat internal communications within the corporation as being a publication. Now, in many states, the internal communication would not be regarded as publication at all, at least if we're dealing with a corporation, because this is, in theory, one person. It's just a person thinking to himself. Texas deals with this a little bit differently. If you have employees or managers within the corporation talking about the incident, reporting it to each other, that's still regarded as a publication, but generally it's going to be privileged. You have a privilege as a manager to discuss your important business problems that would include, naturally, a disciplinary issue with respect to an employee, any possible disciplinary action, and therefore the more likely way to deal with that problem in Texas is not lack of publication, it's going to be privilege. You might wonder whether or not there's a defamation action to be filed against the laboratory. Well, certainly the report is a kind of publication, but again, we're likely to find that it's privileged. Now, what happens when the VP goes out on the road and further publishes the defamatory comments to people outside the corporation? That certainly is publication under any approach to this problem, and it may or may not be privileged depending on the circumstances. We'll talk about that further in just a moment. Second bullet, we have to ask the question whether or not the published message was in fact defamatory. There are two sub-issues here. First of all, some types of statements are so defamatory that we treat them as per se injurious and actionable. The plaintiff doesn't have to prove the actual economic effect of the defamation. He doesn't have to prove that he actually lost a job or lost any pay. We are entitled to assume that the job or the defamation is necessarily harmful, and this will frequently be true whenever the defamatory statement relates to a person's career. There's quite a bit of precedent for the idea that defaming someone in their career is going to be harmful, and proving the amount of the injury is not required. Imagine how important that is if you're a trial lawyer. This saves you from what can be a very, very difficult proof. It's difficult, for example, will be difficult, to prove that you were rejected from any particular job only because of the defamatory comment. Now, if the court determines that the defamation was not that bad, still potentially harmful, but not that bad, we have defamation per quad, which means you might have a cause of action, but you're going to have to prove that you suffered some harm. It wasn't something that was naturally deeply harmful. We're only going to call it harmful if you can prove the way in which it hurts you and the amount of money that you lost. I mentioned that there are two sub-issues here. The second is how we deal with the problem of opinion. And when we're talking about describing the qualities of a person as a worker, note that the problem of opinion can be quite severe and difficult to muddle through, because if I tell people that you're incompetent, it's pretty easy for me later to claim, well, that's just my opinion. It wasn't a statement of fact. I just didn't like the way he worked. And the courts have not always had an easy time of resolving the difference between opinion on the one hand and fact on the other when they're talking about negative comments about a person's career. In the facts in the preceding slide, for example, we have the comment that the worker was a difficult person to work with. Is that an opinion or is it fact? Next bullet. Injury, general versus special damages. The extent to which the plaintiff has to be able to produce evidence of actual loss, again, is going to depend an awful lot on whether the court deems this to be defamatory per se or defamatory per quad. I think I'm going to let it rest there. We won't go into any further detail on the difference between general versus special damages in the employment context. We'll go straight to the next bullet. Was it false or was it true? Truth is an important issue in a defamation case. And the general rule is this. It's the plaintiff's burden of proof, truth or falsity of the defamation, if he happens to be a public official. We make it harder for public officials to bring defamation lawsuits. But if the plaintiff is a private employee, that is, he's not a public official, or maybe he's a public sector employee, but he's not a public figure, for example, the burden of proof would rest on the employer, and truth would be an affirmative defense in that case. Finally, and here's a really big issue, privilege or immunity to publish statements about somebody else. We tend to want to encourage a lot of communication between former and prospective employers. We want to encourage communication between managers within the company, and therefore we say communicate as you like, even if you say harmful things, provided you don't act maliciously. As long as you're acting in good faith, you're just carrying out your job, you're communicating because of your common interest in the subject matter, common economic interest that is, you're not going to be liable for saying something that turns out to be false and defamatory. But if you act maliciously just to cause harm, then you might still be liable. Next slide. Defamation law in Texas. This illustrates a provision, a fairly recent provision we have in Texas, which gives employers a lot more protection in at least one specific context. The most common context for employer defamation is when the employer speaks to other prospective employers, employers who have called the first employer to find out what kind of record the employee had. Now, typically such conversations are privileged. The Texas legislature decided to strengthen protection for employers in these kinds of communications. It did so by creating something called immunity. I suppose you could think of this as a higher level of privilege. The most important aspect of this immunity statute is that the employer is immune from a lawsuit by the employee unless the employee can prove by clear and convincing evidence that the employer had knowledge of the falsehood of the defamatory statement, was acting with malice or reckless disregard for the truth. So employees have a harder time in Texas of overcoming the usual common law privilege if we're talking about communication between a former employer and a prospective employer. Next slide brings us to Churchy versus Adolf Coors, a fairly famous case which creates a special angle for defamation law to the extent that it's been adopted outside of Colorado. It raises some interesting questions, whether it's good law or bad, and it's still a case that plaintiffs try to rely on as they try to expand anti-defamation protection for employees. Next slide. Was there a publication? This is the case in which the employee has been fired for, it depends on how you look at it. Allegedly, she failed to be completely truthful about her reasons for being absent. It's clear enough in retrospect that it was the employer's problem. The employer had some miscommunication. It looks like the employee was probably truthful. I suppose we'll never know for sure, but the fact finder was entitled to reach that conclusion. The employer's HR office or whoever filled out the paperwork, they must have had a bit of a nasty streak in them because it wasn't enough for them to simply say that Churchy was, she missed some time. They alleged that she was discharged for dishonesty. And imagine how that looks to a prospective employer. And, you know, if you're advising employers, the rule is this: you should never be any nastier than you have to be. You may be angry at the employee for all sorts of reasons, but there is just nothing to gain by being gratuitously nasty. And that's what the employer was in this case. And when you're gratuitously nasty, at the very least, you're inviting a lawsuit, even if there's no basis under the law to remedy your nastiness. Now, let's go through a quick checklist of some of the things that are illustrated in this case. Because we're not dealing with a public official, for example, when the company raises the truth defense, it bears the burden of proof. And as I suggested just a moment ago, a fact finder was entitled to find that the company was wrong. They screwed up, and Churchy was not, in fact, dishonest. More important question for the future is, how do we prove external publication by Coors? Because Coors didn't actually tell any other employer that Churchy had been discharged for dishonesty, at least that we know. And here's a real problem in employment defamation, because you don't really know what your former and prospective employers are saying with each other. Their communications are likely to be confidential. They're not going to tell you what they said. Neither the former employer nor the prospective employer is going to be very open with you about this. So how do you know? How do you know what they said, even if you know that there was publication of something? So Churchy's attorney has attempted an unusual theory here. The theory is this: that Churchy self-published the defamatory statement because whenever she looked for a new job, she had to fill out an application form that asked her why she was discharged from her last employment. Now, the application form tells her she's got to be completely truthful, because when they find out that she wasn't, they're going to fire her anyway. So to complete the application truthfully, she says, "I was discharged for dishonesty, but I really wasn't. It was a mistake on the employer's point." Well, if partner. You can imagine that this is not very persuasive with a lot of prospective employers. Anyway, her theory is, I published the statement myself, but I was compelled to engage in self-publication. And this becomes a new theory of publication. The employer should have foreseen that the employee would be compelled, not just likely, but compelled to repeat the accusation. She has to repeat the accusation in theory because she has to fill out future job applications. Next slide. Implications for employment. Well, first of all, we have to point out that the Colorado legislature responded to the Churchy case by overruling the decision by statute. They changed the law to make compelled self-publication not a cause of action in the state of Colorado. Most courts in other states have rejected the theory. I'll just tell you briefly what the Texas experience has been. We have at least one court decision in Texas that has adopted compelled self-publication. We have three or four cases that have rejected it. So I suppose at best you would say Texas case law is mixed, but the prevailing view in Texas is to reject the theory. The restatement of torts is indecisive in its support for the theory. The argument against compelled self-publication is that it can't really be reconciled with at-will employment, because it means that if the employer discharges the employee for the wrong reason, ordinarily that would not have been actionable, employment at will. You don't have to be right. But compelled self-publication raises the prospect that an employer can be sued whenever it discharges an employee for an unfair or wrong reason. Now, even if the doctrine does ultimately gain some support, and as I've said, there are still courts around the country who've adopted the theory, remember that the employee must still overcome employer privilege. The employer is privileged to investigate disciplinary cases and to write up its own reports, to have its own investigatory hearings, and that privilege may protect the employer's right to accuse the employee internally. And the mere fact that the accusation has been made internally won't expose the employer to liability. Next slide. There's a public sector analog. We call it stigmatization of the employee. You may wonder why we need a special doctrine in the public sector. That's because of sovereign and governmental immunity, these bar tort claims. So for a long time, public employees have had a hard time suing their public employers for anything like defamation. But then one day, someone discovered Section 1983, which prohibits the denial of liberty without due process. The classic simple form of denial of liberty without due process would be throwing you in jail without a fair hearing. But there's a theory of Section 1983 that suggests that your liberty interest includes your right to a career and employment. And if the former public employer interferes with that liberty interest by wrongly defaming you without a fair hearing, then they violated Section 1983. Remedies for this are quite limited, mainly because the employer can comply with the law simply by conducting its own informal internal hearing and then defaming you anyway. Next slide. This brings us to the problem of unemployment compensation. This is one kind of monetary compensation that you get even if you're an at-will employee. It's a little bit like a form of private insurance for unemployment. Next slide, public versus private systems of insurance. Why do we have public insurance for unemployment? Why not require people or simply leave it to them to buy private insurance for their unemployment? Well, first of all, some general observations. Unemployment is an individual problem, but it's also a family and community problem. When unemployment strikes the individual, it frequently strikes also people dependent on that employee. But particularly at times like this, unemployment is also a community loss. As unemployment reaches a certain point, unemployment becomes a problem for the entire neighborhood. It's difficult to sell homes because too many homes are for sale and not enough people can buy them. There aren't enough people to buy groceries at your store, and the list of community-wide effects goes on. We have compounding effects of mass job losses when lots and lots of people are hitting the street unemployed all at once. You might still be wondering, why don't we require that individuals protect themselves either by buying private insurance or by saving money to get them by during periods of during periods of unemployment? There are several answers to this, but one of the most important answers at this particular time is that we have an economic system, rightly or wrongly, which depends on consumption. We have tried to energize our economy by encouraging people to spend money, and this has really been a national policy going back for almost a century now. And the difficulty with telling people you have to save money for your unemployment is that you take that money out of circulation. In essence, you encourage people to oversave. And the part of the purpose of the unemployment insurance system is to signal to people you don't really have to save for your unemployment. Go ahead and spend money on a fancier car, bigger house, more luxuries, stimulate the economy, because we're going to provide some public insurance for you if we have job loss. There's also a moral hazard problem, and it's one reason why there are no insurance companies out there that provide private unemployment insurance. We have to assume that there are at least some employees who might not work very hard, realizing that if they get fired, they still have some insurance. They may not try to look for jobs very hard as long as they're living on insurance. That's why private insurance companies don't go down that road. And it still makes public insurance at least a little bit controversial. Next slide, financing a federal-state partnership for insurance. Our unemployment compensation system dates back to the New Deal era. It was a New Deal era law that created this system. It's financed by a federal payroll tax combined with a state tax credit. To put that a little bit differently, either the state can collect the money itself, in which case the employer gets a credit against that tax for purposes of federal taxes, or the state can simply let the federal government collect it all. Either way, the money is then going to be distributed to states to help finance their unemployment compensation systems. Now, the amount of the tax that the employer pays is based on a job loss experience rating. The more unemployment an employer's employees suffer, in other words, the greater the turnover rate, the higher the tax rate. Naturally, the idea here is to give employers an incentive to try not to cause unemployment, to try not to discharge people unfairly, to think of ways of keeping people around without laying them off, because the employer is going to have to pay higher payroll taxes if it's not careful. This is one of those areas where a lot of the details in terms of coverage, level of benefits, eligibility, and disqualification from benefits varies from state to state. We're going to look at some of the common solutions and the answers to these questions that you're most likely to find in the greatest number of states. Next slide. Last slide for this lecture. Basic requirements of eligibility. What do you have to show in order to receive benefits, unemployment compensation benefits? Number one, you must actually file a claim for benefits. Now, you may think that I'm being silly in even mentioning this, but it's an important point for you to remember when you're dealing with people who have just become unemployed. There's a common reaction that people have that they don't need to file for benefits immediately. After all, they may be optimists. They may be hoping they're going to get a job immediately. It may be that they're living off of severance pay for at least a little while, maybe some accrued vacation pay. They'll get around to filing their benefits someday. But here's an important thing that you can tell them. Benefits run not from the date of unemployment. They run from the date that the claim is actually filed. And that means that the faster that they get down there to the unemployment compensation office, the faster, or rather the more benefits that they will actually receive in the end, because their eligibility date runs from the day that they actually filed the claim. Secondly, you must have accumulated a minimum number of wage credits. That is to say, you must actually have some work experience. Your employers must have been paying taxes on your behalf, and the system will record the amount of taxes that have been paid on your behalf with respect to your paycheck, and this will relate then to whether or not you are eligible for benefits at all. It's one reason why people coming right out of school, for example, frequently don't qualify for unemployment compensation, even if they can't get a job for another year or two, because they don't yet have the minimum number of wage credits. Number three, you must register for work. By that, what we mean is that when you apply for benefits, you have to fill out paperwork with the office there that makes you available for job offers. If the office there has work available for you in an appropriate area, they may offer it to you, and you have to be ready, willing, and able to accept that work. Which brings us to the fourth bullet. You must, in fact, be able and available for employment right now. If you're not able and available for employment right now, you don't get benefits. This is a problem for people who try to deal with their unemployment by perhaps going back to school. If they're going back to school full time, this may impact their eligibility for benefits because they have to be available for full-time employment right now. It also means that you're disqualified to the extent that you have become disabled. Now, you may think that's a really hard rule that says that you get nothing if you are seriously disabled so that you can't hold a job. And the answer is, it seems at first glance to be a hard rule, but the truth is that you just happen to be in the wrong line. There is another line to get in. It's the line for Social Security disability income, and that's where you'll get your unemployment compensation benefits. Fifth bullet here, to the extent that the state wants you to engage in these services, you have to actually participate in offered occupational services. If they've looked at you and decided that your problem is that you're just not qualified to do anything, and if they have a job training program, and if they offer that to you, you have to accept it, or you don't qualify for benefits. And finally, here's the thing that we'll be talking about most of all at the beginning of next Tuesday's class. There must be no disqualifying cause. Your unemployment must not be, for example, because of your voluntary resignation or because you were fired because of misconduct. And that's where we will pick up on next Tuesday. That's the end of this lecture.